Welcome to the CB Wallet Podcast. I'm Phil Lucas.
And I'm Phil Gerrards. Why are we here, Phil?
Well, we're going to talk about the greatest disasters in world history and some that you've never ever heard of. What went wrong, how it went wrong, and whether it was our fault or God's fault.
Awesome, Phil. But remember, Phil, it is not our intention to make light of the sometimes quite substantial mortality rate to some of these disasters, is it now, Phil?
No.
We're just interested in finding out what went wrong. And be honest with yourself, Phil, for God's sake, if it came on the news, I reckon you'd be interested, you bastard.
Yes, I would. And you got a problem with that?
What are we whanging on about this week?
Aeroflot Flight 593.
Call the control column. Just call them.
Guys!
A Russian flight to Hong Kong is in serious trouble.
The other way! The other way! To the left, now to the right.
Brevity has become a deadly force as the crew fights to keep the plane from falling 33,000 feet to Earth.
Get out! Back!
The cause of all the chaos? A 15-year-old is at the controls.
Get out! It's right there!
Ladies and gentlemen, we are starting our approach.
This is our first plane crash.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. How have we done 42 episodes? This is our first plane crash.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because Tenerife was basically just a very big road traffic accident, wasn't it?
This is the first one we've done where a plane is in the sky where it goes wrong.
I was thinking as well that I think probably because of lockdown and COVID and the general state of the world, we haven't done a really horrible one for ages.
No, which is why you messaged me and said we need to do one. So I was like, right, I better get on it then.
Well, you have chosen an absolute banger. For the first time since maybe Zeebrugge, I think we should put a little cheeky warning on this. Because right. If you weren't scared of flying before this plane crash, you will have a look around the next time you're on a plane. I wanted as well to refresh the rules of the Crash Band Wallet podcast. Because we've got quite a few listeners. Hello to new listeners. Very kind of you to have you aboard. We've got a rule on the Crash Band Wallet podcast where we don't do terrorism, mate.
No.
And we don't do crime.
No.
There was a little bit of terrorism in
Tenerife,
wasn't
there? A tiny, tiny bit. But, I mean, if terrorists were electronics brands, your ISIS, they're like your Sonys, your Apples. Your Canary Island separatists are very much like your Sharps.
Yeah, they're Amstrad.
Or your
Bush.
The Amstrad. Yeah.
So we don't do crime. We don't do anything deliberate.
No.
So I think that of the non-deliberate plane crashes, because the worst ones are the deliberate ones, right? Like German Wings,
yes.
9/11, obviously.
Yeah.
They're all deliberate ones. But I think of the non-deliberate plane crashes, this is the worst one that's ever been.
Nothing about this needed to happen. That's the sad thing about it.
Nothing wrong with the plane.
No.
Nothing wrong with the weather.
No, absolutely. Any other time, this would have just gone absolutely fine.
So, yes, a little bit of not much of a warning, because it's not, it's a plane crash. What do you expect?
Yeah, it's not going to be bubbles and sunshine, this one, but
no,
it's particularly gruesome as the horrible tale unravels, definitely.
So, Phil Ip Lucas, with all of that said, Aeroflot Flight 593, what was that?
It was an air crash where a passenger Airbus A310 aircraft operated by the Russian airline Aeroflot crashed into a Siberian mountain range. I mean, that's worse. Like, a mountain range is bad enough, but Siberia, that's as bleak as it gets.
Oh, God.
If your plane lands in the Brecon Beacons,
yeah.
There's a chance, isn't there?
There's a chance that
they'll get to you. In Siberia, 2 weeks, a year, anyone's guess.
Yeah, they'd never even find you. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Never even find you. Okay. Okay. When did it happen, Phil?
The 23rd of March, 1994.
How many people died?
75, Phil. That breaks down to 63 passengers and 12 crew. In short, that is everyone on board.
Oh, okay. Well, without further ado, it's not going to be a knockabout. It's not going to be Carrie the Musical. Let's get into it.
No.
But before we get into the horrible nitty-gritty of basically flying a plane into a mountain, let's get the very basics out of the way, Phil. Number one, what in the name of God is Aeroflot? But, Phil, Also, what is an Airbus A310? Sort of plane, is it?
Yeah, I can do both of those, Phil, because I love planes.
Oh, cool.
And I'll tell you what else I can do, Phil. I can do it with the kind of pithy panache that I know you respect me for.
Cue the Wikipedia music.
Aeroflot is the largest airline of the Russian Federation. It was founded in 1923, making it one of the oldest active airlines in the world. Today, the airline flies to 146 destinations in 52 countries. Up until the early 1990s, Aeroflot was the flag carrier and state-owned enterprise of the Soviet Union. During this time, the airline grew its fleet to over 5,000 domestically made aircraft and expanded to operate a domestic and international flight network of over 3,000 destinations throughout the Soviet Union and the globe, making the airline the largest in the world. But with the largest fleet comes a large burden, and Aeroflot was involved in numerous accidents and incidents during its operations compared to any other airline.
So was Aeroflot, like, did they make bad planes then? That sounds like Wikipedia is implying they made shoddy planes.
I mean, it was a running joke, wasn't it? Aeroflot was considered both terrible service and a little bit dodgy in terms of safety. I mean, I can't remember the comedian, but there was some comedian said that Aeroflot's logo should be the original National Lottery fingers crossed sign.
Do you know what it means in Russian, Aeroflot? I mean, aero is pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? But flot. I'll tell you why I say it. Because in English, it's very close to the word flop.
Yes.
Which is not what you want.
Yes. Yeah, immediately it doesn't sound healthy. It actually means air fleet.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But it does sound like aero flop, doesn't it? Which is very apt.
Yeah, you wouldn't fly sort of Finnish Airways called Led Balon or something. Are you going to Finland? Yes, who are you flying with? Are we going Led Balon?
UK drop.
But that's...
Eurosag. GB Flounder.
Okay.
Phil, would you like me to cover your second question with the same pithy panache that I know you respect me for?
If you don't, I'm going to burn this house down.
The Airbus A310 is a twin-engined, wide-body airliner developed and manufactured by Airbus. It was introduced into service in 1983 and remained in production until 1998. In total, 255 were built. Phil, the important thing to say here, right, in terms of this A310 aircraft, mm-hmm. right, this isn't some tonky old Soviet plane that no one's ever heard of that Aeroflot had about 20,000 of, right? This is a modern Western plane that is in use with many of the world's major airlines, and it was state of the art for the time and still not massively dated in the great scheme of things now, really.
This is a real trigger point, right? Because when I was terrified of flying, there'd be little ticks, there's little things where you tick them off, right? And one of them is it's a new plane. It's new. Look how new it is. And like you tell yourself, it's brand new. Oh, brand new. State of the art. And then this comes along and goes, state of the art. We still flew it into a mountain. So it's another thing you can't sort of keep a grip on, you know.
No. I mean, I do sometimes, just as I'm boarding, as you go through the door, I do look. And if round the edge of the door is a bit scuffed, I sort of go,
I don't do it anymore, but I used to study the stewards and stewardesses, like study them. And like, if there was anything on their face that made it look like there was anything wrong, I would panic.
Wow, the amount of makeup, I'm surprised you can see through the face.
Why is that? Why is the makeup thing? Like, it's really strange that it's such a... That they had an idea of how to be a steward and a stewardess sort of in the 60s, I guess. And it really stuck.
There is no reason why flight attendants couldn't just be in polo shirts, just branded polo shirts.
Yeah, no reason at all.
But for some reason, even Ryanair, EasyJet, they give them all the flashy gear and you think, there's no point. It'd be like AA men still saluting you from the side of the road if you went past with an AA badge on your car. It's just madness.
But the thing is, you wouldn't want them to. I think maybe part of it is making you feel at ease, because when you, that's why it is so, it's not really military, is it? But it's very sort of cut and dried and fresh and clean and ironed. You don't want the pilot to get on the back of the plane with a fag on, just walking up in his T-shirt on, going, "We'll take off in a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I think it's chicken for dinner. It's usually fucking shit. All right, then, close your doors." You know, you want some of this sort of theatricality, don't you, to make you feel safe.
You never hear regional accents from pilots, do you?
Never once.
Never.
No, you really don't. You hear this voice, ladies and gentlemen.
I've heard the odd Scottish pilot, but I don't think I've ever heard... "Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be flying on the way to Bangladesh now."
Well, do you know what? I think the reason I was talking to my sister-in-law the other day, and she, one of her friends is trained to be a pilot. She told me how much it costs to train to be a pilot.
Isn't it about 150 grand or something?
It is breathtaking. Yeah. Yes, it is. It's like three figures of grand. Mm. Do you think that some of them have got a regional accent and they put it on? "Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be flying at 50,000 feet this morning. Just, well, today's flight time of about 45 down the hour. So just right back and enjoy the flight. And we'll be there back in the middle of the flight. Okay. Now let's get this fucker off the ground."
That's another thing. It's like, why do the pilots have to give you the same information? Most of it is irrelevant. There's no point in going, we're going to fly southerly. We'll be just passing over the Pyrenees and then heading north over Guernsey or whatever. You think, we're going to fucking know, do you? You're just...
Yeah, that's right. "If you look out the left of the aircraft, you'll see a drop of 50,000 feet. So, Phil.
Yes.
Flight 593, fated flight 93. That's another thing I do when I fly as well. When you hear the flight number, there is something that goes through your mind where you hear the voiceover on the documentary.
What they tend to do if a flight goes down, they will tend to change the flight number in the future if a flight becomes very well known.
Oh, really?
I know Lockerbie was changed. I know they got rid of the Lockerbie flight number.
What number was that?
I can't remember. They got rid of it.
Good point. Okay, so the ill-fated flight 593, what was that, Phil? I'm guessing it was just one of Aeroflot's millions and millions of daily flights, which went absolutely without a hitch. Am I right, Phil?
Absolutely, Phil. A routine run-of-the-mill Aeroflot flight that was supposed to take off from Moscow and land in Hong Kong. Nothing unusual about that. Apart from the fact that on this flight, the pilot had his 13-year-old daughter and 15-year-old son in the cockpit.
Well, okay. Well, I'm not at all happy with any of this, Mr. Lucas. I want the record to show I am not happy with any of this. All right?
You barely scratched the surface and you're terrified already.
If I was on that plane, right, and I saw those two kids going in that cockpit, I would be digging my fingers into the seat rests. I would be making a show of myself. Okay, Jesus. Right. Okay. Well, let's do it then, Phil. Start the fucking plane crash.
Okay. First thing to say, Phil, the plane in this crash, we've covered it. Airbus A310. Nice and new in aircraft terms. This particular aircraft was only 2.5 years old at the time of the crash. So no problems up front with that. No reported problems with it before and no reported problems with it on the day of the accident. This plane is tip-top, tippy-toe, ready to go, A1 Gold Star plane.
Lovely.
Right, we're all set to go with this bog-standard, boring, scheduled flight between Moscow and Hong Kong. Now, Phil, booked onto this completely normal, nothing's going to go wrong, very boring routine flight with 63 passengers.
Okay.
40 of those were Russian nationals. But there were also about 20 business people on from Hong Kong and Taiwan who had doubtlessly been in Russia to see how they could make a quick capitalist buck from the bloated carcass of the Soviet Union, which had just crashed.
Yeah, it's a great time to be alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the aircraft, Phil, was crewed by 12 people. 9 of those were flight attendants. Potatoes or vodka, sir? In the captain's seat was Andrei Viktorovich Danilov. who was aged 40 years old, so highly professional and younger than us.
That's terrifying, at 40 years old and in charge of a plane.
I know. I mean, I'm barely in charge of my own teeth.
No, that's right. Your teeth are off on their own, aren't they? You're not even driving your teeth.
Oh, my God, no.
So, Andrei was 40.
Andrei Danilov, yeah. Now, he had accrued over 9,675 hours of flight time. That's a lot. That's a lot of experience, including 950 hours in this particular aircraft. Not the specific aircraft, but in the type.
This type, yeah.
The A3110. And of those 950 hours, 895 of them were as captain. So, this bloke knew what he was doing, a safe pair of Russian hands.
Who was the co-pilot?
Co-pilot was Igor Vasilievich Piskaryov.
Nice.
Only 33, this chap, but he had 5,885 hours of flight time, including 440 hours in the A310. So again, another safe pair of Russian hands, Phil.
For some reason, you trust Russians at the helm or something, don't you? Get in, we will be fine. Like, you trust them. Like, I'd trust a cosmonaut for some reason over an astronaut. Don't know why. When you trust a cosmonaut more than astronaut?
Well, just because it's a better word. It's a better word, cosmonaut, isn't it?
Do you think America were pissed off when Russia got cosmonauts? Because they're like, well, all of us guys, we're all astronauts. We are cosmonauts. Shit, I wish we were cosmonauts.
It's a great word, isn't it? It's just got visions of those really dated spacesuits.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're red.
Or brown. A brown spacesuit. Yeah. Russians are brave. Is that a stereotype that's not true? But I feel like Russians are brave people.
I think they're pretty full on, balls on.
Yeah.
I mean, we've both read Stalingrad.
Yeah, exactly. And if you ever go on YouTube, have you heard of YouTube? If you ever see somebody like cutting a bush down with a chainsaw with one hand on a ladder balanced on a car, it's a Russian.
Yeah, it's always a Russian. Always a Russian.
Yeah. You know.
Now, Phil, you've got these two pilots, yeah? Mm-hmm. There was also a relief pilot on board this plane.
Yep.
Okay. Now, what is a relief pilot?
Did they used to just piss in his hands?
They are not there to hold the captain's piss. They are captains themselves. And what they do is they accompany long-haul airline flights and they relieve the main pilots during designated portions of the flight. It was Yaroslav Vladimirovich Kudrinsky, 39. He had over 8,940 flying hours, including 907 on the A310. So, Phil, for a third time, a safe pair of Russian hands. So, I've given you an overview of the passengers. We know our crew. We know where this plane was leaving from. And we know where it was going to. What happened next? Tell me now.
So, Phil, the plane left Moscow International Airport at about 4 p.m. local time.
Right.
This 4 p.m. local time at Moscow International Airport started like any other.
I've got facts about that airport.
Go on, then.
It's actually called, and I have no idea if this is pronounced correctly, it's actually called Sheremetyevo International Airport.
Nice.
Sheremetyevo. Anyway, it's the busiest airport in Russia.
Mm.
It's the eighth busiest airport in Europe.
Wow.
And it was originally built as a military airbase, but was converted into a civilian airport in 1959.
The flight time for the trip, Phil, was supposed to be around 13 and a half hours, and it's about 5,000 miles. So, you know, you'd have your eye mask, you know, your comfy socks, you'd have a big old Stephen King, or whoever it's, Stevenich Vasilievich Kingovich, to get you
Nikolai
through.
Gogol, if you're intellectual.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Dead Souls, very apt.
Yeah, that's right. You'd be flicking through your Gulag Archipelago with a different cover on it. Just so you actually made it to the other side. Anyway, for the first 4 hours, everything was absolutely fine, Phil, right? Everybody is getting used to the world-famous Aeroflot hospitality.
Potatoes or vodka, sir?
All was tickety-vitch-boo-a-vitch. let's skip back a bit. Remember that you said that the relief pilot for this flight was Yaroslav Vladimirovich Kudrinsky.
I did.
I don't want to blacken Kudrinsky's name too much in this because I do think he was doing a nice thing.
Yes.
Right? He was trying to be a good dad. If there are any dads out there, don't try and be a good dad. it's embarrassing, if anything else. just hang back. I always find it a little bit icky when a dad's too involved. Do you know what I mean? So be happy when they get good grades, but don't know what they're in.
Don't call me dad. Just call me Steve.
I am his dad, but actually we're mates. You're not mates. Okay, anyway. So Kudrinsky, he was a good dad. Hmm. Right. Now, what kid, Phil, answer me this, doesn't like going to work with their dads?
Oh, yeah, I loved it as a kid, yeah.
What did your dad... Well, your dad worked on the trains, though, didn't he?
Yeah, so he used to take me into the train sheds on a Sunday.
Well, my dad was a gardener, so it's like, oh, come out into the rain and stand by this hole.
Yeah.
But, Phil, this was no normal day to go to work with your dear old dad because these two kids were going on their first ever international flight, right? Imagine how excited they would have been. Plan was that their dad and the two kids were all going to spend a few days in Hong Kong together.
Oh, lovely.
Now, Kudrinsky's wife, and obviously the mother of the children, wasn't on the trip, but she did happily wave them all off from Moscow airport, which is in itself quite painful, isn't it? So, on this flight, amongst the passengers, we've got the Kudrinsky's two kids, and they're just sat on the plane. They were sitting with a family friend called Vladimir Markarov, right, who was also an Aeroflot pilot, but he was off duty, okay, just like, you know, sat with the kids for the flight. Now, Kudrinsky, obviously, he was in the cockpit, right, getting ready to do his duties at the time of the takeoff in the co-pilot's position. Once the takeoff was out of the way, and the plane was up in the air and flying along for about 4 hours, so they're well into the flight, Kudrinsky was going to take over as the main captain. Whilst the main captain, Captain Danilov, goes for a break, which I imagine includes vodka, caviar, a little bit of espionage.
Mm.
That means that Piskaryov, who spent the first part of the flight in the cockpit jump seat, becomes Kudrinsky's co-pilot, right? So essentially what you've got is the main captain is out of the cockpit and you've got the two other pilots flying the plane, right?
Exactly.
All's going fine. Let's recap. In the cockpit, we've got Captain Kudrinsky.
Yes.
Next to Kudrinsky, we've got his co-pilot, Piskaryov.
Yes.
Seated amongst the passengers, we've got Captain Kudrinsky's two excited kids, who, as we've already said, have never been aboard before.
Oh, nice.
We've got 13-year-old daughter, Yana Kudrinsky, mm-hmm. and 15-year-old son, Elder Kudrinsky.
Right.
Everything's ticking along nicely. Most of the passengers are happily asleep. Oh, God, is it nighttime? And the plane is smoothly heading towards Hong Kong. Now, at this point, it's just started flying over Siberia. This is the point where everything starts to go very south very quickly, right? Dear. Now, as we've often seen in these disasters, Phil, especially ones like this, it's very little things that start a chain of events that ultimately leads to something absolutely horrific. Mm. And this has got so many times when they could have just, oh God, they could have just decided not to do any of this.
Yeah.
Like the next 15 minutes, they could have just gone, oh, should we just not do any of this? But they do it all. The first little thing in this case is the family friend sitting with the pilot's children. You may remember him, Vlad Makarov.
Yep.
He just idly suggests that it might be a good idea if they all go to the cockpit to see their dad.
Mm.
And so really, that's the catalyst,
yes.
isn't it? Like, if we didn't do that, none of this would have happened, right? It's not like you can go, oh, it would have happened differently. It just wouldn't have happened, mate.
Yeah, nothing would have happened.
And even if they'd said, can we go and see him? He could have gone, he's flying a plane.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Everyone would have survived. Anyway, so needless to say, the kids jump at the chance. They're pretty up for that.
Yeah.
And they all go up to the cockpit, right? So now we've got five people in the cockpit, right? So there's the two pilots, the family friend, Vladimir Makarov, and Captain Kudrinsky's two kids, Yana and Elder. Five people in the cockpit. That's too many people in the cockpit. Captain Kudrinsky then uttered these 12 words, Phil, to his teenage daughter that no passenger ever wants to hear on a plane ever. Phil?
Come and sit here now in my seat. Would you like that?
I mean, on the plus side, he did warn her not to touch any buttons, but I mean...
Oh, fair play to him then.
Now, incidentally, if you are playing by the rulebook at this point, when Kudrinsky left his seat, he didn't formally hand control over to his co-pilot, which is what you're supposed to do, right? Mm. So that meant... So what he should have done if he was going to do this mad thing, I take it, was that he would go, do you want to sit in my seat? But before he got up, he would formally hand over control of the plane to the co-pilot, right? Mm. And then she'd sit in a seat and it would be like she was flying the plane, but she's not, right? But he didn't do that, which meant that Kudrinsky was still officially in charge of the aircraft, right?
Right.
But now it's not Kudrinsky sat in that seat, it's a child. Even though the plane's on autopilot, at this point a 13-year-old girl is flying this plane, right? If this situation wasn't worrying enough, Phil, Kudrinsky's next 14 words are even more chilling.
Hey, Yana, would you like to fly the plane? Go ahead, take the controls.
I mean, all this is on the black box, right? So this is exactly what they said.
Yes, exactly what they said.
Despite what, I think we can call it an appalling breach of the rules.
I think we can, yeah.
Without anybody cancelling us. Captain Kudrinsky, he wasn't... we don't want to give the impression these people were idiots. He wasn't an idiot. What he did was he kept the autopilot on, right?
Yeah.
So he's not literally saying, do you want to fly the plane, right? Mm. But he did sort of slightly adjust the course settings. So when his daughter was holding controls, it felt like she was turning the plane slightly to the left, but she wasn't, right? The autopilot was still on, yeah?
Right, so he adjusted the controls so the autopilot would slightly turn the plane. She turned the column to make her think that she was turning the plane, but she wasn't. So
yeah, a nice little trick to make her feel like, oh my God, I'm flying a plane, when actually it's still safe. Yeah. But we have to remember what the effect that might have had on the 15-year-old boy who's watching his sister fly a plane. That's the problem. Because he is going, oh, I can fly a plane a bit fucking better than that. Anyway... Once Yana has had her fun, she gets out of the captain's seat, right? And the co-pilot puts the autopilot back to its original course, right? Mm-hmm. And then he puts in a routine call to air traffic control, telling them their course.
Right, okay, fairly normal.
So Yana, the daughter, has not done anything to the plane at all, really, at this point. All she's done is sat in a chair and she's held the steering column, right?
Yeah.
Now, 15-year-old Elder wants to have a go at the controls, right? This is important. There was something a little bit different about what happened when Elder sat in the pilot's chair than when his sisters had, right? Because at first, Captain Kudrinsky didn't adjust the autopilot settings the same way that he'd done for his daughter, right?
Oh.
That meant that when Elder sat in the chair and held the control column, it was very stiff. He couldn't move it because the autopilot was keeping the plane on its pre-programmed route.
Right, okay. So a pilot couldn't just go, oh, I'm going to change things. The autopilot's going, nope.
And I would have thought that probably would have pissed off Elder, because he'd been like, my sister got to turn the plane and I'm not allowed, right? Or I can't do it. So he started putting a lot of force on the control column to try and move it. His father then adjusted the autopilot settings the same way he did for his daughter. And so Elder was then able to feel like he was doing the same sort of small banking movement that his sister had done, right?
Mm.
After that, Captain Kudrinsky pressed a button to put the autopilot back into its original setting, just like he'd done with his daughter.
Right, okay.
But, Phil, Elder was still holding the control panel tightly as if banking the plane to the left.
Right.
When the autopilot becomes engaged, the controls become stiff again. Captain Kudrinsky isn't too bothered about that because he's talking to his daughter. He's not really watching.
Brilliant.
And that means that Elder, who's being quite heavy-handed with this stick, is at the controls playing around. He then turns the control column to the right.
Right. Okay.
Now, Elder has been in the pilot seat for 3 minutes, right? It's at this point that he says to his father, why is it turning?
God.
And Kudrinsky says, is it turning by itself? Elder says, yes, it is. And so Captain Kudrinsky then replies with 6 words, I don't think in any situation you want to hear a pilot say, I don't know why it's turning.
Jesus Christ.
Now there follows 2.5 minutes of absolute chaos. Right.
Oh, God, yeah.
What's happening during those 2.5 minutes is the plane is tilting sharply and the turn is getting steeper every second. So the plane appears to be turning by itself, but nobody knows why, because as far as the pilots are concerned, the autopilot's meant to be flying the aircraft. But it's the fucking kid who's flying the aircraft.
Mm.
We're now at the point where the plane is banking at 45 degrees.
God, you would know that. Yeah.
And what's really scary about that is that is a steeper angle. What's really scary about that? One of the things that's really scary about that is that's a steeper angle than the plane is built for. It can't fly at that angle.
Jesus Christ.
And it's still 15-year-old Elder who's in the captain's seat.
Because he is just pushing the controls to the right the whole time.
Yes, that's right. Now, we'll get on to why this happened in more detail later. It's to do with the autopilot, how the autopilot responded. But just to rub salt into the wounds, it's at this point that the information on the cockpit primary display screen just disappears.
Oh, God.
Everything goes off. This means that the crew, they don't have any information about the course or the heading. That's important. You might think it's not important because they're flying a plane on its side, right? But it becomes important later. They don't know where they are in the sky anymore. Now, they start to move beyond the point where the plane is banking at 45 degrees and we're moving closer to 90 degrees.
Wow.
Way in excess of what a plane like that is designed to do. Right? This is like a stunt plane territory, right? That's
God, yeah, yeah.
That angle creates G-force. Fucking G-force, Phil. Right?
Wow.
And it weighed everybody down in the cockpit.
Yeah, I mean, G-force, you can't even lift your arm up, can you?
Yeah.
G-force.
You know, to spell that out, you've got a plane with 75 people on board. It's in very serious trouble and operating well beyond its design limits. In the captain's seat, you've got a 15-year-old boy. That little boy can't now get out of the captain's seat because the G-force in the plane is pushing him into the seat.
Oh, my God.
They can't even pull him out. So it's not looking good. And the G-force is also making it difficult for the co-pilot to reach his controls and do anything either. They're stuck.
Oh.
All the passengers in this plane are feeling this. You can't bank at 45 and then 90 degrees and, you know, still be drinking your vodka and thinking everything's peachy fine.
You'd be shitting yourself now, wouldn't you? And I think the G-force at this point would make you feel about twice your normal weight.
And you know what else is out back with panicking passengers? The other captain on his break.
Oh, God, yeah.
And he can't get back to the cockpit because of the G-force, right?
Oh, my God.
So with all this going on, it's great to know that a 15-year-old boy is the only person with two hands on the controls, right? The only thing being done at this moment to try and rectify the potentially dangerous situation is there is a pilot shouting basic control maneuvers to this kid who's in the captain's seat. They're literally screaming at him, trying to teach him how to fly a plane. You got about 3 minutes to learn how to fly a plane, right?
Wow.
Or we're all dead. It's not ideal. Now, remember I said the plane was doing a 90-degree turn?
Yes.
Now, a 90-degree turn in a plane, that means it's literally on its side, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It can't do that and stay in the sky. So the plane starts to descend very, very quickly.
Right.
One of this aircraft's many safety systems aboard senses that it's fucking crashing, right? And tries to compensate by pitching the nose up and increasing the thrust.
Right.
Now, that's all fine and that's all good. But the problem with a manoeuvre like that, Phil, is that it risks stalling the engines.
Mm, yeah, you're putting so much power into the engines, it's going so high that it risks stalling them because of the power and the climb.
Well, so I've never understood what stalling the engines mean. This is because of jet engines. You need so much air going through them. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So there's not enough air going through the jets to...
No, I mean, obviously you'll try and do that because it's better than letting the plane just plummet. So you're going to try and put the power on to get the plane up.
Yeah.
But there is therefore the increased risk of the engine stalling as you do that.
Well, why isn't there more air going through the... Because there's air everywhere, isn't there, I've been told?
It's thinner air. Whether that has got anything to do with it, I don't know. But these are the facts, Phil.
Okay, so... So essentially, it may or may not be to do with the thinness of the air at this point. But all we know is that this can stall the engines. Okay. As a result of that, the remaining elements of the autopilot that were still working stopped working. Right? Now they're off autopilot. There wasn't enough computing power. Computer says no. The autopilot went, I'm sorry, lads, I've done my best. But I do not know what's going on. Right?
Because that's just what you want with an autopilot, isn't it? Just to bail out at the moment it's at its absolute worst.
Well, I mean, cut it some slack. You put a kid in the... It's like there's so much an autopilot can do. Okay. Now, in the cockpit, we have some altitude warnings going on. The autopilot disengagement warnings are happening and the stall warnings are all sounding in quick succession. So there's going to be a lot of noise, beeps and...
I don't know if you've ever heard black box recordings when all the sirens are going off. It's horrendous.
Terrifying.
it's a horrendous thing because the pilots are fighting. They're trying to talk to one another to rectify the problem. And you've got three or four different tones going off. Some of these warnings are like a computerized voice going, warning stall, warning stall. It's oh my God, I can't even believe.
So
begin
stressful.
To imagine how stressful that would be.
Terrifying. The plane, Phil, begins to descend at speeds of 10 feet per second.
Jesus.
Is that a falling speed?
Yeah. Vertical feet. 10 vertical feet a second.
Oh, my God. The plane fell so quickly that it nearly reached its breakup speed, which means it's literally just breaking up in midair. Is that right?
Yeah, it's close to that, yeah.
Now, Phil, is there anything remotely positive about any of this? No, not really. But one thing that plunging out of the sky does do is lower G-force. Right. Ah. So that is slightly positive, right?
Right.
And that meant that Captain Kudrinsky could get back into his seat.
Right, yeah.
We know this because the aircraft's voice recorder has him shouting to his son the words "get out" 9 times. Kids' man must have been absolutely fucking beside themselves with terror.
Oh, God, yeah.
Captain Kudrinsky got into the pilot seat and he was able to work with his co-pilot, Piskaryov, which is handy because the plane was currently diving at a rate of 40,000 feet a minute.
Jesus, they only fly at about that.
It is some going when you think that a normal passenger plane usually flies at about no higher than 37,000 feet.
Yeah, so if you're in a plane and you're about 3 hours into your flight and you're able to look down, you would hit the ground in a minute. That's absolutely terrifying.
Okay, I wish you hadn't told me that. Okay,
well, sorry.
So the co-pilot. Okay, so the co-pilot, Piskaryov, managed to pull the plane out of the dive. How on earth did he do that?
God,
but he managed to do it, right?
Wow.
But he overcorrected and the plane went from hurtling nose down to a near vertical ascent.
Oh, God, can you just imagine that?
So explain that to me. So they were falling towards the ground and he pulled up so much they went vertically upwards.
Yeah. We've had a plane banking to the right.
Yeah.
To a point where it's not designed to take it.
Yeah.
It is then falling out of the sky.
Yeah.
So the autopilot kicks in, raises it up, so it shoots up into the air.
Yeah.
Then the engine stall, so it falls again and it's diving. So then the co-pilot gets control of it, overreacts, and instead of it diving, he shoots it from nose down to straight up.
So they've gone on like the world's most horrific fairground ride.
Yeah.
Fucking Alton Towers from hell.
We're not talking takeoff vertical. We're talking, well, vertical ascent is what it is. So, horrible, horrible, horrible.
So you can't fly a plane straight up.
No.
It stalls the plane for a second time, right?
Oh.
The plane then falls out of the sky in a corkscrew dive. Like like if you've thrown a paper plane up into the air and it's corkscrewing down.
Some plane crashes has one of these things.
Yeah.
This has got everything happening that could conceivably happen with a plane before it crashes. This is horrendous.
It is twisting towards the ground from 19,000 feet and falling at 230 feet a second. Corkscrewing down towards the ground. When you get on a plane, apart from terrorism, this is all of the things you're terrified of. Like, all of the things. Right?
Yeah.
Amazingly, though, Kudrinsky and Piskaryov managed, even in this at this point, to regain some control and level out the wings. So they got it out of the corkscrew.
How the hell they... I mean, fair play to them.
Fucking cosmonauts, mate.
Yeah. Wow.
Right, this is the final kick in the balls. Like, this is like the absolute ending kick in the balls of this whole horrific affair. It looked like things were going to be all right because they leveled it out, right? So they regain control of the aeroplane. And on the black box recording, the relief in Captain Kudrinsky's voice is really obvious. He says, "We'll get out of this. Everything's fine. Gently, gently. Pull up gently." The problem was, do you remember earlier how all of their instruments had failed and they weren't... So they had no idea how close they were at that point to the ground.
No.
Right? They had no idea that they had descended far further than they thought. And their altitude was much lower, far too low to recover. And it turns out that Kudrinsky's words, "Everything's fine," were the last words that were said on that plane. Obviously, everybody on board was killed on impact or engulfed by the huge fireball that followed the aircraft hitting the hill.
Oh, my God. That is...
So, as non-terrorist air crashes go, it's got to be up... Well, I don't want to say it's got to be up there, but it's got to be one of the most terrifying.
It's just that horrendous 2 to 3 minutes of it just... Every conceivable angle, I can't get over. It's up, it's down, it's corkscrewing, it's levelling out.
That is freaking... awful. So what happened next, Phil?
Well, the search party went out about 2 hours after the crash, which is pretty good going considering we're talking Siberia.
Yeah.
And it wasn't actually long before they found the wreckage. The next thing Aeroflot did was fly the relatives out to the crash site and then to a nearby morgue to identify their loved ones. Now, unfortunately, many of the bodies were too badly mutilated to be identified. And the families had to look at recovered bits of clothing and personal possessions in an attempt to identify the deceased. So they're looking at bits of clothes, shoes, photographs, Jesus bags. It's just, that is horrendous.
I get the timeline of events and I get that something seems to have changed once the 16-year-old elder got into the captain's seat. But what actually happened, Phil? That kid sitting in a plane, just moving the column to the right, it doesn't feel like it should have made all of those things go completely so badly wrong. Why on earth did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, we've got an idea that he's done something the autopilot has screwed up somewhere along the line. So I think the first thing to say is that it didn't take too long here for the rumours to start circulating that a child was at the controls of this doomed plane. And with that nugget of information, it's pretty easy to draw an immediate conclusion as to what happened. And that doesn't look too good on Aeroflot, does it?
I wouldn't have flown Aeroflot ever again.
No.
I would have written a strongly worded letter, and I certainly would not have gone on an Aeroflot flight.
Not that I'm suggesting the Russians have got a form in this, but the airline initially denied there were any children in the cockpit of the doomed aircraft.
What a shock.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure why they did this, because there is no way that wouldn't come out in the accident investigation.
The denial itself is enough. Like, if British Airways came out and said, "British Airways can categorically deny that there were no donkeys in the cockpit."
Needless to say, Aeroflot did have to do a very quick backtrack on this when a leaked transcript of the cockpit voice recording got out into the public domain. So everyone knew that there was, as we said before, and I quote, "a kid in the cockpit." But, like you said, Phil, that still doesn't give us any sort of real decent answers. So the first thing to say from the air crash investigation is that it was determined that the aircraft got into trouble after poor little 13-year-old Yana had left the controls. But that is not the same when old poor heavy-handed Elgar took over the captain's seat, because the black box shows that 2.5 minutes before the crash, the autopilot partially disengages. Now, this is the start of everything that goes wrong.
So Kudrinsky thought that when Elder was in the pilot seat, that everything was on autopilot.
Yep.
But it wasn't.
No.
But that wasn't something he'd done. He didn't, like, press a button.
Well, we shall go into that, Phil. Now, the altitude of a plane are controlled by three key functions on the plane. You've got the rudder, which is in the tail of the aircraft. That controls the sideways movement of the aircraft.
Okay.
You've got the elevators, which are also in the tail of the aircraft, and they control the vertical movement of the plane.
Right.
And then you've got the ailerons in the wing, which, you know, you will have all seen those when we're flying. They go up, they go down.
They're like air brakes.
Yep, that's it. You could put those up to slow it down, but they're also used for turning.
Okie doke.
On flight 593, the autopilot had disconnected itself from the ailerons.
So basically, everything in the tail is still working.
Yes. The autopilot is still controlling the sideways movement, the vertical movement of the plane, but it's disengaged from controlling the turning. And remember, we had Eldar turning the plane to the right.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, okay.
Now, you're going to ask, how the hell did that happen? Because it's not mentioned in the cockpit voice recorder, which suggests that the pilots weren't even aware that it had happened. Unlike his sister, Eldar starts to turn the plane before his father adjusts the autopilot settings. Remember that when he took the controls of the plane, he found them like really stiff and hard to move?
Yeah.
That's because he was unwittingly fighting against the autopilot. Not one person in the cockpit knows it, but this is the absolutely critical moment. Because Eldar's force and resistance against the controls for about 30 seconds actually turns that part of the autopilot off. The system is designed to do that.
But why? Why is it designed to do that?
It's designed to do that because, for good autopilot does, there's no question that sometimes you need to take manual control for whatever reason. So what Eldar's done there, because he's just being a kid, just going, it's not working. So he's applying loads of force. But that force has turned that autopilot off. In short, you've got a 15-year-old boy steering this plane with 75 people on board. So he is actually the pilot. And the scary thing is, though, Phil, that is not the only reason the aircraft crashed.
Really?
The discovery of what happened with Eldar uncovered a flaw in how those pilots were trained on that plane.
Well, you wouldn't thought you'd need to be trained not to put your kid in the pilot seat.
Well, no, there's that. But they didn't realise that the autopilot had been disconnected.
Oh, yeah,
because remember when the pilot said, is it turning by itself? I don't know why that is. Because the pilot's thinking it's on autopilot. So he's like, well, why is the autopilot turning that? And he didn't realise it was actually his son doing it.
You would think it was a problem with the plane then. You would go, oh, the plane's gone wrong.
Yeah, you'd think the autopilot... In fact, what actually these pilots thought... They thought the autopilot was putting it into what they call a holding pattern. You know, sometimes when there are too many planes for spaces to land.
And they go in a circle.
They just go around in a circle. They thought the autopilot was putting it into a holding pattern, which is a weird thing to do because they weren't over any airport. But anyway, that's kind of what they thought, but they didn't know why. But the thing here is that this particular plane, this Airbus A310, only has a small light on it to tell the crew that the autopilot or any part of that autopilot has disconnected. There's no audible alarm.
Oh,
now,
shit.
This is completely different to the older Soviet-made aircraft that all these pilots had started out flying and had done the majority of their flying careers on. In those older planes, there was an audible warning. And in training for the A310, the pilots just weren't taught this difference. So they weren't looking for it when the problems started occurring. There's just a little light, which obviously they just missed.
Oh, that sounds so stupid, doesn't it?
Yeah, so stupid, isn't it? But, Phil, but there is another reason the pilots didn't realise, okay? Because, as we said, the autopilot on the A310... only partially disengaged. It's still controlling the other functions of the aircraft, and because of this, the pilots think it's working fine.
I mean, I would think that an autopilot, I mean, not a pilot, as you know, but I would think it was either on or off.
Exactly.
I wouldn't think it was like, oh, I'm controlling the coffee machine, but not the heated seats, you know.
Be like... Exactly, Phil, because you have got the old Soviet mindset going on there.
I have,
because
yeah.
In the older Soviet aircraft that, again, these pilots were used to, you can't have that situation. The autopilot is either on or off because it's not as advanced. There's no part measures with these older systems. You can't have a bit of it on, a bit of it off. And again, the pilots weren't totally up to speed with the sophistication of this new Western Aircraft's autopilot system.
So am I right in thinking that if they had been trained, then literally this bloke could have gone, oh, and just turned the autopilot back on?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. That's good to know, isn't it?
Yes, because if they'd have known, the moment Eldar goes, well, it's turning to the right, the pilot would go, oh, okay, yeah, I can see why.
Yeah, because you've disengaged. What you've done there, Eldar, is you've disengaged the autopilot.
So what you've got here is a situation that when Eldar notices that the plane is banking to the right because he's doing it, the pilots don't understand it because they think it's actually the autopilot that's controlling the turning of the plane, not some young kid who doesn't know what he's doing. And in this situation, every second that it stays like that, the whole situation is just getting worse and worse. So the short of it is, Phil, that is why this plane starts banking beyond its design limit and losing altitude. So other parts of this autopilot system are now kicking in to try and solve this problem. It's why you get the aircraft's nose being pulled right up and the power to the engines increased to try and maintain that altitude as the plane is banking and falling. And of course, whilst it does that, it's creating that G-force that we've heard about.
Yeah.
After this manoeuvre, you've pulled the power up to try and increase the altitude. The engines then stall and all the remaining parts of the autopilot then disengage. So that's everything. Now, the plane is pretty screwed after this, and we all know how it ended. But, Phil, there is one very, very sad bit to all of this, right?
Yeah.
When that plane entered the corkscrew dive,
which is the scariest bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it's as scary as it's gonna be. It's entering the corkscrew dive. Now, this is the final dive before they manage to slightly level it, and then bang, they hit the mountain. Now, both pilots were madly wrestling with the controls here to try and get this plane out of the corkscrew dive. Yeah, but all they needed to do from the very beginning of that corkscrew dive was take their hands off the controls and sit back. And then the plane's emergency survival program, separate to the autopilot, would have kicked in and just righted the plane automatically. And there would have been no crash at all.
Oh, God, that's fucking horrible, isn't it?
Ironically, the pilots could have sat back, done nothing, and the emergency survival program would have kicked in and righted the plane.
It's so counterintuitive, though, isn't it? I mean, if you were in that situation, you'd have to have some presence of mind and also some control over the other people in that cockpit to go, the best thing we can do is nothing.
Yeah. It's just against human nature, isn't it?
It's against everything, isn't it?
I mean, obviously, you could apportion blame because he let his kid sit in the cockpit, but very difficult to apportion blame in terms of wrestling your way out of that situation, because there's so much going on and so many things that they'd never experienced and most pilots will never come across in their entire careers.
Needless to say, Phil, Aeroflot improved their pilot training a fair bit after this.
Oh, that's good.
And there's no more bring your kids to work days in Aeroflot. Yes, they sent a stern letter to all of their pilots telling them not to let their kids fly their planes, which you wouldn't have think...
Wise.
I mean, when they're penning that, you think you'd be going... the first line of that would be like, I cannot believe we're having to write this letter. But don't let your kids fly the plane. The important thing is that no 15-year-old kid has ever played a key role in crashing a commercial airliner since. So we've...
Oh, good. Well, that's something.
We've closed that loophole, Phil. How do you feel about that? That's good, isn't it? So all I can say is, if you've been slightly scarred by this episode of the Crash Bang Wallet podcast, you can go to bed safe in the knowledge that no 15-year-old child has ever crashed a plane into a mountain ever again. So that's good. Well, Phil, I think I know the answer to this, but that was the, I mean, for people scared of flying, the absolutely anus-clenching story of Aeroflot 593. Was it our fault or God's fault, Phil Lucas? Before you say, I have an inkling. I'm not saying, I'm going to put all of my chips on red. Okay, I'm going to spin the wheel and let's see where it lands. Our fault or God's fault, Phil Lucas?
Well, Phil, huge passenger planes, yeah?
Yeah.
With living, breathing people on board them are not computer games.
No.
And therefore, kids should not be playing on them.
No.
So it was sort of the pilot's fault, but I sort of say that with a bit of a heavy heart, because what he did was terrible, but he was just trying to give his kids a memorable flight. Which I guess in one way he sort of did do that, didn't he? But
well, yes. I mean, but of all the podcasts we've done, this is the worst human error, isn't it? Mm. The only one I could think of which is similar to this is Quentin's Hill, where they're just not watching. Just
oh not yeah, yeah.
You know, or maybe the other plane crash one we did when they were watching football.
Yeah.
But even that's sort of different, isn't it? Because that's just not watching, not being involved.
Yeah. This is actively letting a small child sit in a...
This is a decision that was made that is outside of the normal running of flying a plane.
Yeah, it's not to consider good practice.
No, it's a little bit like... He decided to fly it with his feet just to see if he could.
Yeah.
I decided to fly with my feet and I killed everybody. But so, Phil, have we had reviews? I feel like we have had reviews.
We have had reviews. I've got them here, Phil. I've got one here from Dr. Chaz.
Doctor who? Dr. Chaz?
Dr. Chaz. I don't know if he's a medical doctor or a intellectual doctor.
If Dr. Chaz is a medical doctor, I say go elsewhere. Get a second opinion if your first opinion was from Dr. Chaz. Hey, everybody!
He wrote, or she wrote, it's a bit of an eye-opener. The two Phils could have been a classic Victorian comedy double act. Instead, and fortunately for those of us who love this quintessentially British style of humour, they put their own spin on some of the most famous and not so famous disasters and cock-ups from the annals of history.
Oh, I love the word cock-up.
History. Cock-up. Yes, rhymes with Dennis Norden. Funny and irreverent, cock-up. Funny and irreverent, cock-up. But always respectful to the topic at hand, cock-up. They romp through a wide range of subjects from the well-known to the obscure and do so in a highly entertaining and informative way. More power to your elbows, guys, and have a virtual pint on me. Highly recommended. Thank you, Dr. Chaz.
Thanks,
that's
Dr. Chaz.
Lovely. Great use. There's some brilliant words in there. Like you say, there's cock up, I like. I love romp. Romp is something that only celebrities do in hotel
that's
rooms.
That's true. And since the demise of the News of the World, people haven't been romping quite as much, have they?
No.
But they used to romp in the pages of the News of the World.
Yeah.
We had a lovely review from Matty Smokes 69. He's a Canadian gentleman.
Oh.
He says, a public inquiry would find Phil and Phil at fault for making one of the funniest and most well-researched podcasts out there. The business disasters are especially interesting and unique. Thanks, Matty Smoke 69. I like the business ones, and but I do think it's nice that we've done a really horrible one.
Yeah. see what he thinks about that. I've got one more review from, I'd like to say Bayern, but it's B full stop Y full stop Ian. So it's BY Ian. So I've got a review from BY Ian.
BY Ian.
He has put, again, I'm saying he, it might not be Ian, it might just be Bayan. I love these podcasts, they say. Extremely funny, especially considering the hard subject matter that they deal with. It's not a theme that you'd think lends itself to a comedy podcast, but they make it work. Luck, thank you. The guys managed to walk the tightrope of using dark humour to inform us about both the well-known and the more obscure disasters without falling into the disrespecting trap of the subject matter. Not all the disasters have ended in death or destruction, though, and there they can really go for it. yeah, you're not wrong there. I mean this in the best possible way. They know a lot more about the subject than you think they do. Oh, thanks. There must be a lot of research that goes into each podcast, and you can be sure that for all the jokes, the facts are spot on. Well worth your time. Oh, and one of the Phils likes trains, which is always a plus. Thank you. That's me. I like the trains.
That is Mr. Lucas. We had one from the United States of America, Mr. Philip Lucas.
Ooh.
From a person calling themselves LLS411,
ooh,
who I think is possibly a robot. But he, she, they, it say, my favourite podcast combined with my favourite author. I think they're talking about Stephen King there, because it was a Stephen King episode last time. Wasn't
ah, it? Right. Yeah. Okay.
You've outdone yourselves. I just had to write a thank you review. Thank you very much, LLS411. Keep the episodes coming. I'm in the US and times are very dark. Times are a bit dark, aren't they, Mr. Philip Lucas? It's a very depressing time to be alive in the world. Here's hoping things get a little bit better. What do you reckon?
Yeah. We need lockdown back. That's what we need.
You had the best times of your life during that lockdown, didn't you?
Bloody love lockdown. I had a fabulous time. I miss it. Yeah, so that's all the reviews. Thank you very much. They are lovely. We're so grateful. We love getting reviews, and we really do appreciate that you take the time to do them. So thank you. Talking of reviews, do keep them coming, folks. you may not know this, but you probably guessed it. We're not very good at marketing this podcast.
We're not great at it, no, I've got to be honest. I was listening to one of the old Ultimate Scrutiny episodes the other day. More about that later, actually. Not in this podcast, but later podcasts. We'll talk a bit more about that. But there was a time when we tried to put the Patreon up for Ultimate Scrutiny. And your advert for getting people to put money into the Patreon is one of the most begrudging things I've ever heard in my life. You're going, don't do it. Don't send us any money. It's just not worth it. We don't know what we're doing. Spend it on something better. But yes, sorry, no, you're right, we're not very good at marketing.
We're not, which is why my current life partner Julie, who by trade is a professional marketeer, has a degree of success,
but doesn't have a degree. Let's make that clear.
She does. It's in fashion now. No, but she has essentially gone, you boys are utterly crap. And she has very kindly said, I am going to take on board this and try and tidy things up for you. First thing she said to me was, you use Twitter and not Facebook, don't you? That's stupid. No. So right. We'll still use Twitter because we like Twitter, because we can talk to you and stuff like that. But in terms of actually content and stuff, we'll be using Facebook a bit more, because she told us to, and also she'll be doing it a lot more with our blessing. So you'll see some differences. We'll be using Instagram a bit more, we'll be using Facebook a bit more. Things will look a little bit more professional, because somebody who knows what they're doing is on board with it, at least temporarily.
Awesome.
So thanks, Julie.
But it's already worked, though, has it? We got people coming talking to us on Instagram.
Straight away, we got a message back. I didn't even know you could message people on Instagram, but you can. And this, I think, is a very nice message, because it deals with something that we have chewed over amongst ourselves for a while. And this is this person's opinion on it. It's John, J-O-N, I don't know the surname, but he's put, hey guys, really enjoying the podcast. My girlfriend showed it to me and I'm totally hooked. So thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
I noticed in one of the shows that you were wondering about whether it's okay to do a comedy accent from another country or not. And I wanted to give you my rule of thumb.
Oh, cool.
Okay. If your country has ever done a colonialism on their country...
Done a colonialism. Yeah.
The accent is off limits unless they did a colonialism back. So Indian, bad. Chinese, bad. In brackets, opium war. Australian, good. Aboriginal Australian, bad. French is fine because they gave as good as they got. And that's the same for most of Europe. American is always funny, but a Native American accent is probably off limits. There are some exceptions, like Ireland, which we think is fine, but the Irish don't for some weird reason that I'm too English to understand.
Potato famine, mate.
Just thought you'd find it interesting. Love the show.
I think that's a fabulous rule of thumb, John, and we will adopt it. But if anybody else wants to take issue with John's ideas about what accents we can or can't do, then get in touch with us. Don't get in touch with John. He's got other things. don't pile on John just for giving us his measured opinion. Get in touch on Instagram, is it? I thought it was Instagram.
What are we at Instagram? At CB Wallop Podcast. We are on Twitter at CB Wallop. We are on Facebook, just Facebook Crash Bang Wallop. One of the things Judy told me is put a lot more photos up. I was like, all right.
Oh, okay. Yes, and say hello to Julie, our new, what would you call her? Marketeer sounds sort of vaguely sort of totalitarian to me.
In that case, we'll go with it.
And we'll be back in whenever we can get the next one done, I suppose. Phil Lucas, have you got anything to add?
No, very hot.
Are you? I've always thought so. Thank you so much for listening to the Crash Bang Wallop podcast this week. We will see you next time.